It's great to be with you on Palm Sunday, and I was here 2 years ago on Palm Sunday, and Margaret had a bit of a conversation about whether people would remember that I was here on Palm Sunday and remember the sermon. Margaret didn't think you would. I actually don't think you would, but a couple of people did remember that I was here on Palm Sunday, so we're not going to do Palm Sunday this time. But it's great to be with you. And what I want to do, though, is I want to think about approaching the king. And I want to think through these two stories about how we approach the king and why we should approach the king, using both of these two miracle stories to think about him. And there is a protocol to follow if you want to approach the king. If you're in this country and you accidentally run across the king, or you run across a member of the royal family, there is a protocol. I googled it because I'm not familiar with it myself, so I thought you'd be interested to know how you should approach a member of the royal family should you just bump into them at the level crossing or the crossing in mass, wherever it might be. So this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to clear the path and stop and bow, kneel, or at least lower your head. If you're in a narrow corridor, you are to stand to the wall with your eyes lowered, don't look them in the eye, if you're in a crowded passageway. You're saying nothing if the king is in conversation with someone else. You can offer a greeting if the king is silent. Address the king as your majesty when you first meet them, and as sir or ma'am after that. Bow or curtsy when you greet them. Stand when royalty enters the room and wait for them to sit before being seated. And keep your conversation polite and impersonal. Don't talk about yourself, whatever you do. And that was what I got off Google about how you should approach the king. And I want to think about what it is to approach Jesus. How we should approach Jesus and why we should approach Jesus. The earlier part of this chapter, in the bit before Edith read, is teaching that Jesus gave about clean and unclean things. And his basic summary is that the stuff that actually makes us clean is already there within us. It's not what goes into us. It's not the food that we eat or other kinds of things. It's what's already in and comes out. That's what makes us unclean. And in both of these healing stories, Jesus is in Gentile territory. He has gone from Galilee into the vicinity of Tyre, and later he's in Sidon. And both of these places were non-Jewish areas, although there would have been a number of Jews living there. But these were Gentile territories that Jesus had gone into. And he'd gone to get away from the crowds. It was one of those things he never seemed to have much success in doing. He seemed to want to get away quite regularly to go and have a break, and every time someone found him. So even like the feeding of the 5,000 is the result of him going away to try and get away from the crowds and the crowd following. So now he's kind of forced out to go into Gentile territory. But even there, he is known. And it made me think, you know, how did they know it was Jesus? They didn't have TVs, they didn't have newspapers, there weren't pictures up around of who Jesus was. And clearly there was a to-ing and a fro-ing, and people had heard about it, and people would have been going to see him or hear about him or even just pass by and see him. But this woman had heard about Jesus. She'd heard about his reputation. The secret was out. And as soon as she had heard that Jesus was there, she came to see him. She is a Greek-born woman from Syrian Phoenicia. And she came and found him falling at his feet, begging and crying out for Jesus to heal her demon-possessed daughter. Now think about the context. The context is clean and unclean things. And here is a woman who is Greek. She's a Gentile. She's a Gentile who isn't interested in... She's not one that's converting to Judaism. She's not one that's interested in Judaism. She's a pagan. That's why we're told these things. And she's a woman, and women were not held in high esteem or high regard within Judaism. And also she has a demonized daughter. How, you know, that she could not be any more unclean by the standards of the Jewish people of Jesus' day. But yet she stands in contrast to what's gone before. She stands in contrast to the hardening unbelief of the Pharisees, who, even though they've seen all the brilliant and wonderful things that Jesus has done, are still refusing to believe in him. They want, in fact, to arrest him and to get rid of him. And she stands in contrast also to the lack of understanding of the disciples who are going around, they're hearing all Jesus is teaching, and yet they're still struggling to get any sort of glimpse or sense of who Jesus is. And so this is a story which I guess perhaps sometimes we find difficult to understand. Why does Jesus seem so reluctant, even harsh, when he deals with this woman? I've heard this preached as if the woman was some proto-feminist who challenges and changes Jesus' attitude to women. But I don't actually think that's what's going on here. I remember one of my lecturers at Bible college, he was a guy called Dick France. And he was a lovely, lovely guy. He was commenting on this story. And he was saying, that what we cannot see is the expression in Jesus' face. And we cannot hear the tone of Jesus' voice. What we've just got is a flat account, and we read it, and we kind of don't see or imagine what's going on in the dynamic. But if we take the story as it is and the woman's response, then we perhaps can see that she is not hearing this as something that is harsh, she's actually hearing this as something that's inviting response, inviting her to consider and to think. So I want to think about how this woman approaches King Jesus. It's not with the royal protocol which we thought about at the beginning, but it isn't without regard for who she's approaching. She's approaching someone that she has time for, someone that she believes can help her. So that's the first thing that I want us to know about approaching Jesus. She comes to Jesus because she believes he can do something for her. She believes that what she's heard, or perhaps even what she's seen, he can do something about her situation, about her little girl, her little child, who has this demon, is possessed by this demon. She obviously knows who he is, and his reputation has reached into Gentile territory. And I think that's important, and it's so obvious, it's really obvious, but it's worth asking ourselves, do we actually approach Jesus with expectation? Do we approach Jesus with expectation when we pray? Do we approach Jesus with expectation when we come and we gather to worship? And did you come this afternoon expecting that you're going to meet with Jesus? Because that's the promise, isn't it? That's the promise for us. So where are we on the expectation scales? She was someone who believed that Jesus could do something for her. And believed, I think she believed he would do something. And so we should, given what we know he has already done for us and what he has promised, as John was sharing in his testimony, we should come with expectation. We know what he's done for us. We know that he's given himself on the cross for us, that he's come to this earth for us. For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. This is what he's done. Think about what he's promised. In John's gospel, Jesus promised that we would do even greater things than he had done. Now, I can't get my head or imagination around what that might be, but that's the promise. That's what Jesus said his people would do, his church would do. In Ephesians, I love that prayer in Ephesians 3 that Paul prays. And he prays that God would do immeasurably more than all that we could ask or imagine. I mean, that's incredible. We could imagine a lot, can't we? But Paul says that God can do immeasurably more than all we can ask or imagine. So what is our level of expectation as we approach Jesus? Even now, today, in this service, what's our level of expectation of what Jesus might do? As we've already noted, it seems, at least on the surface, that Jesus did not seem to welcome her intrusion. In Matthew's Gospel, where the same story is told, the disciples want to get rid of the woman. They want to rush her out of the room. They want, because she's a nuisance. But we're told that she perseveres. And the sense of the word is that she kept on asking, kept on begging, kept on saying. The people were trying to hush her. People were trying to get rid of her. But she kept on insisting, kept on persevering. And this is the bold persistence. She keeps on asking and won't be put off. And this is an aspect of prayer that Jesus highlighted in some of his teaching, but it's one that we so easily forget, isn't it? It's one that we so quickly forget, that we have to have bold persistence in prayer, that Jesus wants that, encourages it, teaches it, because there's a purpose for it. Because in a sense, he always is looking to develop our faith and grow our faith. And one of the ways he does that is by encouraging us into this bold persistence in prayer. Now, one of the key things that as a parent you have to teach your children is delayed gratification. Now, my children were very fortunate because they had Margaret as a parent. But because she was the master of doing delayed gratification. Because if you talk to any of my three daughters, they will tell you that I'm a pushover. So Margaret single-handedly taught our children delayed gratification. And one of the things that keeps coming up, and it still comes up now as adults, was about ears being pierced. Our girls started wanting to have their ears pierced when they were about 7. And Margaret said, you've got to wait till you're 13 before you can have your ears pierced. You've got to be teenagers before you can have your ears pierced. And she was good to her word. But you can imagine how often this subject came up over the course of these years. We want to have our ears pierced. All our friends have got our ears pierced. The girls at church have got their ears pierced. Why can't we have our ears pierced? That they needed to learn delayed gratification. And Jesus, in his love for us, is teaching us something about faith here. He's teaching this, some of the commentators think that what's going on is that Jesus is testing this woman's faith, the genuineness, the realness of her faith. Because there were all sorts of miracle workers around. What did she actually perceive in Jesus? And I would say that when we have this experience of delayed gratification, it's something about our character, something about our faith, something about revealing our hearts that God is doing in those situations. My mum alluded to it, because obviously we have a similar kind of thing. But at the moment, Margaret and I feel a bit like Job in chapter 1. You know, all the people that we care about, there's something going on in their lives that's painful and difficult. I'd rather be Job in chapter 1 than Job in chapter 2. So if you ever see me on top of an ash heap, I've moved chapters. But we feel that. There's lots of painful stuff happening in people that we care about. Now, do I want God to use these things to teach me, to grow up and to grow me, to develop my character, to deepen my faith? Yes. But will I keep on asking God to change those situations? Yes. And will I do everything that's within my power to change those situations? Yes, of course. You know, it's not that we're sort of some fatalists that just give ourselves over to the situations that we're in. But in every circumstance, God can and will and does develop us, develop our character, deepen our faith, if we allow him. And that's, I think, an aspect of this approach to Jesus that we make to the King of Kings. We do it with bold persistence. We keep coming, we keep coming, we keep coming. And then, thirdly, the woman humbly engages with Jesus. This is how we approach Jesus. We humbly engage with him. The words of Jesus, I say, seem harsh to our ears. Jews commonly referred to Gentiles as dogs. And it was an insult. But the word that Jesus uses here is not the word for the wild scavenger dogs, the dogs that would have been roaming around, the filthy things that you wouldn't want to go near, who would bite you if you went near them. But rather, it's little dogs, possibly even puppies. Those kind of smaller domesticated dogs that would have been under the table. No one would have heard this. This was not the usual way that Jews would refer to Gentiles. And his answer to her should be understood as a kind of parable. Not a sort of, there's an invitation within what he says. An invitation to see herself in that phrase. And it's a parable that she understood. In fact, one of the commentators said that she is the first person who understood a parable of Jesus. Who understood where they fitted in the parable. She saw that she was one of the little dogs under the table. And she accepted that that was her place. And she comes back to Jesus with her response. And so Jesus is saying, as we know he's saying, that there's an order. He's come to bring the kingdom of God in the first place to the people of Israel, and then it will go to the Gentiles. But that's later, it's down the line. The woman's reply in verse 28 is therefore, yes, Lord, But the little dogs get to eat from the table too, and I'm here for mine now. There will be a moment, but I want mine now, I need mine now. And it's incredible to think about how she engages with Jesus. She didn't take offense at the mention of dogs and storm off offended, like, oh, if you're going to be like that, well, I don't want what you've got. But she responds to the subtle invitation of Jesus that she saw and heard in his response. There are two ways that we can miss the invitation of Jesus to come to him. We can be too proud. We can say, I don't want that. If that's the terms, I don't want that. If I have to recognize I'm a sinner, I don't want, if you want me to recognize I've got a problem, no, I don't want to do that. We can be too proud, or we can be too unworthy, like Uriah Heep. I'm ever so humble. I'm not worthy, Lord, I'm not worthy to be, I'm not worthy of your grace, of your goodness. Tim Keller wrote in his little book on Mark's gospel, it's called King's Cross, about this story. He says this: she's not saying, Lord, give me what I deserve on the basis of my goodness. She's saying, give me what I don't deserve on the basis of your goodness. Mm-hmm. Now that's what John said, isn't it? That's what John said. That's what she's saying. And she's saying, I need it now. I can't wait. Lord, I need it now. And that's grace. And this is the amazing news. We approach Jesus not on the basis of our worthiness, but simply on the basis of his goodness. His grace is full of grace. And then she simply takes Jesus at his word. It's amazing, isn't it? Then he told her, for such a reply you may go. And she went. She just took him at his word. So let's move to the second miracle story. Again, it happens in Gentile territory. This time, it's a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And he was brought to Jesus. And so I'm wanting to suggest that here, this is why we should approach Jesus. What we see in this story is why we should approach Jesus. From verse 32, it's not actually clear that they expected or were asking for his healing. They don't actually ask for his healing. They just asked him to place his hands on him. That was just the way you bless someone. They were actually perhaps just asking for a blessing. And perhaps this is an example of one of those times when Jesus does immeasurably more than all that we can ask or imagine. But why come to Jesus? Well, he's full of compassion. That's a good reason to come to Jesus. He's full of compassion. Not just here, but throughout the Gospels, we see Jesus reaching out to the lost, the least and the last, to the broken and to the hurting, to guilty sinners steeped in shame. And none of these things disqualify them or disqualify us from approaching Jesus. That's the amazing thing. You know, there's all sorts of things that would disqualify you or me from approaching Charles III. But there's nothing that disqualifies us from approaching Jesus. Nothing. He's full of compassion and he's willing to receive us. You know, I don't know about you, but we like our stars and celebrities to be friendly, don't we? You know, we want to hear good things about the people that we hold up as our heroes. We want them to be people who have time for us. And we want to hear those stories about them. Now, those of you who know me a little bit will know that I'm a huge fan of Bruce Springsteen. And I've got to tell you, there are loads of stories about how amazingly good Bruce is. And he's always interested in all his fans. There's loads of stories about him. It thrills me when I hear them. He's willing to receive us. You see, Jesus has time for people. This is a good reason, isn't it, to approach. Jesus has time for people. He has time for you and he has time for me. This is not a royal family on a walkabout. Jesus is willing to engage personally with this man. He took him aside from the crowd. In verse 33, and he put his fingers in his ears, he spat and touched the man's tongue, sighed and said, Ephphatha, I'll get Edith to say it. Be opened. Let's say in English, that's better. And so what's happening here? Because, you know, that's not like Jesus, is it? Certainly not like Jesus in Mark. There were many wonder workers who had their rituals. Is this something similar? Well, no. Everywhere else in Mark's gospel, up to this point, it's just been a word, just a command, and the healing had been done, the miracle had been done. The most likely understanding is that the man himself needed these physical acts. That there was something about the physical act that helped the man to receive the healing that Jesus wanted to bring. And so this is, that is the third reason to approach Jesus, because he knows and deals with each of us personally. You know, Jesus did not have a one-size-fits-all approach to ministry. He didn't see every person in exactly the same way and deal with them in exactly the same way. And the way King Jesus will work in your life is custom designed for you, because he knows you. He's the one who knitted you together in your mother's womb. He knows everything about you. He knows how you tick, and he'll know how best to work in your life. He knows you better than you know yourself. And I just have a brief aside here, because I think this, just because perhaps it speaks to me, but we need to learn from Jesus here that there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to anyone. We need to be people who think about the people that we're approaching and what will work best with those people. You know, I was saying this morning that, you know, I've got a particular sense of humour. I think I'm hilarious. But it's dry and ironic and sarcastic, my sense of humour. And if you don't have that sense of humour, or you don't have a sense of humour, you... Percy, there it is again. And, you know, you might get the wrong end of the stick. Because actually, sometimes, you know, actually, that's a way of expressing affection. It's a, for me, but actually, I have to think about who I'm speaking it to. This is one of the hard lessons I've learned through 30-something years of ministry. Not everyone gets it. And some people hear it as a barb, or get being got at. And so I've had to learn that lesson. Those of you who remember Andrew Nelson from Red Cow Baptist Church of the day, well, no, Andrew, big Texan lad, if he could have, he would have carried two revolvers with him. And his, he was a lad who just, there was only one way to communicate with him. God had made him such. The only way to communicate with him was essentially to get him by the collar, ram him against a wall and shout at him. Because he didn't get any of the subtle nuances of the British way of communicating. You need to look at this. You had to tell him, you had to shout at him. His people are made differently. And you have to have a different approach. And I think that's, Jesus treats us as individuals. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? He knows you and he treats you as an individual. And just as in the story of the woman at the command of Jesus, the man could hear and talk normally, we should come to Jesus because at his command our lives can be changed. At his command, if we come to him for forgiveness, he'll forgive us. At his command, he will change us and transform us. He'll meet with us. He'll heal us. He'll touch our lives in the way that he wants to touch our lives. And just two final brief things to finish. Hopefully that will bring us to that place where we just want to worship King Jesus. The word that is used to describe the man's condition is a very, very rare word. It's the only time in the New Testament it's used, and the only other place it's found in the Bible is in the Greek version of the Old Testament. And it's used in Isaiah 35. And we've been singing choruses from this era, but there's a chorus from this era that is, "Therefore the redeemed of the Lord shall return and come with singing unto Zion." Because that's where it's found in Isaiah 35. And the context is verse 4. "Your God will come in vengeance with divine retribution. He will come to save you." This is a promise that the Messiah's promise. And then what does he say? "Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy." It seems likely that in using that word, Mark is signalling to us, his readers, that Jesus is the one who's come to save his people. That he is the promised coming king, who today we remember riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, the lowly and humble king, not coming to drive out the Romans, but to die for the sin of the people. A king, but not like any other king. And then finally, there's this wonderful, lovely, sorry, little phrase in verse 37. "They were overwhelmed with amazement." Isn't that good? What a lovely phrase. They were overwhelmed with amazement. Why? Because he does everything well. They were overwhelmed with amazement. When we consider Jesus, are we overwhelmed with amazement? Are we overwhelmed by amazement by who he is and by what he's done? Because if we are, we've lost something. He isn't any He is not less amazing and overwhelming than he was on the day he saved you. If anything, he should be more. He should be more overwhelmed and amazed by who Jesus is. I pray that God will save us from ever losing our wonder at the grace of God as we experience it in the life, death, and resurrection of our King and Lord, the Lord Jesus. Let's just worship him and honor him.